Parks connects professionals in the life science, medical device, and food industries with useful content like webinars, job openings, articles, and virtual meetings to help you succeed in your career. This Food Industry Focus podcast brings together some of our editorial staff to share insights into the latest B2B industry news to help keep you up to date. This week on the show, we're discussing the growing importance of food industry cybersecurity and Dash Water using upcycled fruit in its new sparkling water. Enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the X-Talks Food Podcast. I'm Sydney Perlmutter, food industry journalist and webinar moderator at xtalks.com, and this week I'm joined by Aisha Rashid. Thanks for coming today. So I'm going to start us off with a story about a company called Dashwater, and they are a UK-based company that uses, quote, wonky fruit in their sparkling water. So Victoria Beckham and Robbie Williams are among the celebrities who have been spotted with Dashwater in hand, and it's the UK's latest sparkling water craze. So the London-based brand has built up a strong reputation as a better-for-you beverage that uses upcycled ingredients. So the company was founded in 2017 by Jack Scott and Alex Wright, and the pair were on a mission to not only make a healthier drink, but a sustainable one as well. Because as we have spoken about previously, the food and beverage industry is one that is quite detrimental to our environment. So they wanted to create something more sustainable. And their backgrounds in farming sort of exposed them to a lot of produce that would go to waste just simply due to their imperfections. And since that plays a large part in, what produce is put on the shelves, it's very superficial. Scott and Wright decided to give them a second life by infusing Dash Water with the wonky fruits and vegetables. So on their website, they say, "We infuse our delicious sparkling water with real wonky fruit. That's the bent, crushed, curved, misshapen, knobbly fruit, which others say no to. By accepting the misfits, we are helping to reduce food waste." So as for the product itself, the beverage boasts a very short ingredient list of only sparkling water and upcycled produce, and it has no sugar, sweeteners, or calories. And it comes in, currently, it comes in five flavors: black currant, cucumber, lemon, raspberry, and peach. And then each can is also made from recyclable aluminum, and they can be purchased in trial packs or individual flavor packs on their direct-to-consumer website. So after finding a lot of success in the UK, Dashwater also recently announced that they were expanding into new markets. So the business secured a nationwide listing with 700 Woolworth stores, which is an Australian supermarket chain, as well as placement on shelves of 800 independent retailers across the country. So since the beverage uses upcycled and local ingredients, the expansion marks the first time that the company has been produced locally outside of the UK. And this is kind of an interesting point, too, because their supply chain is a lot different than, another beverage company that would source consistent ingredients. Now that they're being produced in Australia and with plans to expand to other countries as well, they have to make sure that their supply chain is consistent and they can get those upcycled ingredients that they were using before, and it could potentially spawn new flavors as well. So the brand's goal is to sell 1.5 cans in Australia by the completion of its first year on the market, and they're also planning an expansion into the wider APEC, which is the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation region, with the company already confirming listings with retailers in New Zealand and Singapore. So Dashwater is not the only upcycled sparkling water company, very specific, on the market. There is another company called Flossom, which is a UK-based beverage brand that started off as a cold-pressed juice brand, but expanded into sparkling water as well, with some really yummy-sounding flavors like rhubarb and apple, sweet and sour apple, and cherry and apple. And then another player is a Chicago-based brand called Zoka, and they make use of discarded cocoa fruit pulp in their functional sparkling beverages as well. So in the wider sparkling beverage market, Dash Water has some major competition, including beverage giants like Nestle, Pepsi, Coca-Cola, and Keurig Dr. Pepper. And according to a report from Grandview Research, the global sparkling water market size was valued at $29.71 billion in 2020, and that's expected to grow at a compound annual growth rate of 12.6% between this year and 2028. However, to date, Dash Water customers have helped the company save 547,000 kilograms of fruit and vegetables from going to waste. So I ended off the article by just asking how many other sparkling water brands can say that. So I thought this was a really interesting company. And while they are not necessarily alone, it seems like they have definitely set themselves apart from the others. And like I said, we've seen other upcycled beverage brands before that make use of, you know, potentially discarded fruits and vegetables. But I just thought it was interesting that it was going into a sparkling water. I think they really are capitalizing on two very big trends right now, which is upcycling and sparkling water. So, what are your thoughts on this company, and would you try it?
Yeah, I would definitely try it, number one, I guess I'm answering your second question first. And my thoughts are that, like you said, they're hitting sort of two birds with one stone, or kind of like getting into two niche markets with the sparkling water and then the trend, or the, I don't know if it's a fad, but of upcycling, but really, really cool. But I have a couple questions. Yeah. One is, where are they sourcing their upcycled products? I'm assuming supermarkets would be the primary source for them, or consumer waste. I'm not too sure. And then the other thing I was thinking about is, will they be able to maintain consistency? Like, would there be variation in taste? Because, you know, you might have a banana now, like, how, you know, long would it be sitting, like, for it to be, okay, I'm just trying to, I'll just say, like, if it's rotten, you know, is it, like, 2 days old, rotten, or 5 days old? And there's going to be a drastic sort of difference in flavor between bananas, depending on how old or how rotten or how, you know, or how or how wonky they are.
Yeah.
How wonky they are. That's what I'm trying to say.
Okay, great question. So to address your first question, I couldn't find exactly where they source it from, but what I would imagine from having written about other companies that use upcycled produce, mm-hmm. is that a lot of it actually comes from producers and farmers themselves. A lot of them are damaged, or, you know, become wonky during transportation. So a lot of them don't even make it to the shelves themselves. Now, you're probably not wrong either in that some of it may come from supermarkets as well. I think they have pretty good quality control in terms of, so it's kind of going into your second question, in terms of making sure that they're not using necessarily like rotten fruits and vegetables.
Right. Yeah,
I think they tend to use the more superficially damaged ones with, you know, a few scratches on the outside, or that were bumped or dropped on the ground or something. And I think they just extract as much of the good that is still in them, rather than, you know, using the parts that no one wants to eat, whether they're in a beverage or on their own. So, and in terms of maintaining consistency, I would imagine that they will be maybe at some point having a lower stock in certain flavors, and maybe introducing new flavors depending on the seasons, because seasonality is a big part of this as well, I would imagine. That kind of remains to be seen. But from what I saw on their website, they have five flavors that are consistent. Those flavors are the produce that they use, like cucumber, lemon, whatever else it was, a black currant, raspberry, and peach. I would imagine that they've chosen those ones because there's a more consistent oversupply of those fruits and vegetables as well.
Yeah, that makes total sense now. Like you know, you're using produce that is like bent and misshapen mm-hmm. as opposed to like rotten.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm thinking that. I'm thinking of like the grocery stores with like the saran wrapped, mm-hmm. you know, produce going kind
yeah.
of.
Yeah, that's a sad case because those are when yeah. fruits and vegetables are really on their deathbed and yeah. have seen better days. but sure. I think what Dashwater and other companies that upcycle do is they get them in that, you know, pre-death stage. They get
right,
them
right.
they just get the ones that
they just don't look pretty.
Yeah, yeah. They don't look pretty, but they may yeah. taste perfectly fine.
Yeah.
And yeah. as consumers, I think we're kind of guilty of that having been
Gosh,
a thing.
Yeah.
And it's very evident just in, you know, what's left behind at the grocery store too. Now I'm not saying I would be purchasing the saran wrapped fruits and vegetables because those I just don't know. Those yeah. are really pushing it in terms of rottenness. But right. I would definitely still purchase a slightly bruised apple or like a lemon that had a few scratches on it because mm-hmm. yeah, it's we know that it's nutritionally it's the exact same, and you just have to use your discretion as a consumer, I would say.
I agree. I mean, I think we've just gotten so used to those perfectly shined mm-hmm. apples. I mean, it's not a shoe that's being, you know, why are we equating, like, why are we looking for apples with the perfect shine? That's not, if you go to an apple orchard, that's not how it is, mm-mm. right? But we've just been conditioned, I think, by the industry, the food industry, to think that that's how our apples should be. And it's really, really bad. And I think to change those kinds of behaviors and that mentality is going to take a shift. But I think we're kind of getting there because, like you said, like now I go into a supermarket and I'm like, you know, just because an apple isn't shiny, actually, it shouldn't be shiny.
It should, exactly. You have to wash it off anyway.
Wax. Exactly. You shouldn't be waxed up. And so I think there's more awareness around that. But coming back to this beverage, and again, I think I mentioned this before, like with all these celebrities, like mm-hmm. this is such a fad among celebrities to be jumping on to and backing functional beverages mm-hmm. and things like that. So you said that this is just available as in a sparkling water form, right?
Yes, like, that's right. And
not in,
yeah, not know, in, not in still.
Yeah, I know that it's a huge market, like you were saying in your article. It's what, like
nearly a $30 billion market.
$30 billion yeah. market. Wow, like it's grown mm-hmm. right in I think in the last several years. But it'd be nice to have a non-sparkling version of it as well for people who like me who may not be so inclined towards sparkling water. But no, I definitely see it like being such a huge market, like it definitely makes sense. And and like you said, there was only one other company, Flossom mm-hmm, you mentioned mm-hmm. that is doing the same kind of a thing, right? So it could be a niche market that they can capitalize on.
Yeah, it's quite niche, and I agree with you. I'm not a huge fan of sparkling water either. And perhaps it is in sparkling water format, potentially to mask some taste, or I don't know. Maybe it was a strategic like play, not just in terms of like the popularity of sparkling water, but the flavor mm-hmm. as well. But and in terms of the celebrity endorsements, I say with air quotes because I don't know if they were actually paid to be drinking them, or I think they were just spotted drinking those
okay,
things.
Okay, they were spotted.
Yeah, I think they were just spotted with it in okay. hand. And who knows if that was, you know.
I wouldn't be surprised, though.
I wouldn't either. I was going to say that. It's like.
That whole world is quite staged.
Yeah, is it really their choice anymore, or was someone putting it in their hand and told to go mm-hmm. walk out into the world? So it's.
To be paid for it.
Exactly, to be paid yeah. for it, or at least yeah. in free beverages. Yeah. So very hard to tell what's real and what's not anymore. Mm-hmm. But I think we both, you know, like the ethos of the company and what they're doing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm going to shift gears quite a bit to talk about a very important topic in the food industry, which is cybersecurity. So there have been a number of cybersecurity incidents that have occurred in the food industry over the last little while. And the faces of those involved in these cyber attacks are rarely revealed, and we rarely find out, unfortunately, who is responsible. But these high-tech criminals are really highlighting the need to focus on food industry cybersecurity. So last week, an Iowa-based farm services firm called The New Cooperative experienced a cybersecurity incident that forced its systems offline before the U.S. Farm Belt harvest, so at a very crucial time. Luckily for them, the threat was contained, but the outcome could have been detrimental to agriculture. And unfortunately, like I mentioned, this is not an isolated incident. And in many cases, the outcome is a lot worse than that. So take JBS, which is a meat giant, and they experienced a ransomware attack in the spring that cost the company $11 million. So in this article, I sort of just talk about why cyber attacks target the food industry and how organizations can take a much broader and more holistic approach to cyber security. So hackers tend to target the food industry because there isn't, while there isn't much to gain from an information perspective, there is a lot to gain financially, and especially with the rise of cryptocurrency. So you think, what does it benefit hackers to break into, you know, a food manufacturer's system that controls their food packaging and their food distribution? It's money. So engaging in cybersecurity or ransomware attacks, when hackers do this, they intend to cause chaos and financial loss for America's food system. And the risk is only heightened as the food industry becomes increasingly interconnected through blockchain, AI, and other digital networks. And while hackers tend to go after large multinational corporations like Amazon and banking institutions, they're gradually targeting industries that are more prone to caving under attack, like the food sector, because we all need food. So food industry cybersecurity isn't as simple as installing new software and just calling it a day. Hackers are very high-tech criminals who are consistently looking for new tools for their trade. And as these cyber attacks occur more frequently, it's very important that the right systems are in place to help prevent and mitigate and also recover when a breach occurs. So today, a lot of food industry players with robust networks, cyber attacks have become less of a what if and more of a when scenario. So according to the FBI's 2020 Internet Crime Report, nearly 800,000 cybercrime complaints were received in 2020, which resulted in losses of more than $4.1 billion. And that figure represents a 69% increase from the year prior. So potentially COVID had a role to play in that. Mm-hmm. With that in mind, food industry cybersecurity can be broken down into three levels, which is before, during, and after a breach. So before an attack, it's really important to build an inventory of both your information technology, IT, and operational technology, OT, assets to more readily characterize your security risk within a specific environment. So if you have the proper inventory, lifecycle risk can be minimized and those critical assets can be maintained. And then until recently, the ability to detect when a cyber attack was occurring was nearly impossible. But new security technologies can provide continuous monitoring and detection for normal day-to-day operations. So if any incident that deviates from the day-to-day task, such as incorrect maintenance, there would be an alert. And that way, a manufacturer would know when to shut down its system, as was the case for New Cooperative. So after an event, organizations should be more firm about their response methods. So proper response and recovery programs like backup and disaster recovery procedures for applications can help ensure a speedy return to normal operations. And this all comes at a cost, of course, but despite that, food industry players could be saving more time and money in the long term, and it may be worth the investment just for the peace of mind alone. But no matter the reason, food industry cybersecurity does not only benefit manufacturers, but the entire food system as well, which includes retailers and us as consumers. So just wanted to get your thoughts on this and whether you knew about, you know, the food industry as being like a big target for these cyber security attacks.
No, I had no idea until the JVS episode that you wrote about the meat industry. And I was really shocked that, but then when you think about it, it's not surprising because it's such, you know, the food industries are huge. And so you're, you know, for these ransomware attackers to target them, it makes total sense. And, but it's very, very concerning. I mean, you're shutting down such an essential service, right? And we saw that with JVS. And I think it was last year during the pandemic. And then we saw the effects where there were shortages of there were meat shortages happening. And we thought, oh, it had to do with COVID and things like that. But turns out that that was due to a ransomware attack. And I think the general public is not so aware of that. I have, like, I was also wondering, like, you know, what types of ransoms are these kind of attackers asking? Like, is it in the millions and the billions? Like, is there any data on that?
Well, so in the case for JBS, they ended up losing $11 million. And think it definitely depends on the size of the company as well. I think hackers, you know, they are smart people and they don't use that intelligence, unfortunately, for good. yeah. So I think they kind of know what they're dealing with when they're asking for yeah. ransom. And they may, you know, overshoot their shot a little bit and ask for, you know, some billions of dollars. And I would imagine there's a lot of negotiating that goes on, you know, because companies don't want to lose money, but attackers want to get as much as they possibly can. So, and so that FBI stat, that wasn't just for the food industry, that was for, you know, all industries as well.
All
but
in
2020 alone, there were $4.1 billion
That's
in
insane.
Losses.
Yeah.
And like I said, that was nearly 70% higher than the year before. So clearly COVID had a role to play. I think the more, you know, as I was saying, the more prone to caving under attack and the more, you know, essential an industry is, the better target it is.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess, you know, during COVID, a lot of industries, especially within food and supply chains, were a lot more vulnerable because, you know, the outbreaks going on and a shortage of workers and things like that. So prime target for sure. Mm-hmm. And I'm also just wondering, like, it's also concerning that it's cyber, like you mentioned that cyber attacks have become more of a when than a what if kind of a situation. And it's like, wow. I mean, there are cybersecurity companies, and I guess is the technology just not quite there yet, or are industries not willing to sort of implement and pay for that? Or, you know,
it's
kind of a combination.
It's
maybe
more of the latter, I would say. There is definitely technology there. It is still difficult oftentimes to prevent an attack because hackers can usually outsmart any sort of system. But there is technology in place to alert when an attack is happening, and then, you know, companies can take the proper measures to stop it and you know, mitigate those negative effects. But it's more of the latter because these do not come at a cheap price. They are expensive to implement, but like I said, it could end up saving them more money in the long run. And it's just you think the risk isn't that high, but it actually, you know, historically, especially in the recent past, like it is kind of high. So I think companies really have to take initiative and just make that investment for themselves and for, you know, the security of the food system in general. And since there is no like overarching agency that dictates what security systems are in place, we unfortunately just have to rely on the individual food companies to make those decisions.
Yeah, and if the frequency of these kinds of attacks goes up, maybe there mm-hmm. could be sort of a governing body to address and deal with these types of cyber attacks. But very concerning, especially when it comes to food supply chains,
right.
because they're just, really hitting a vulnerable spot there.
Exactly. And you know, we can live without Amazon. Mm-hmm. for a day at least, and we can probably live without our bank system going down for a day or two, but
yeah.
food is one thing that when the supply chain gets disrupted, we feel those kinks for like days and possibly weeks
yeah.
to come, as we did during COVID and as we still do. It's a really vulnerable industry to sort of mess with, and
yeah.
and hackers know that. There should be, maybe in the future, if this continues to happen, at least like subsidized cybersecurity. But I would say that most companies that would need it can probably afford it. It's just about making the investment and realizing that the risk is real.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And absolutely, if it becomes like a growing problem, then I'm sure that they would take measures to invest more on that side of things.
Because mm-hmm. oftentimes it takes an attack like that to happen to realize, oh, shoot,
we have a problem.
We have a problem. We're not immune
yeah.
from this. So yeah, it's a lot kind of, it's just like taking care of your health too. It's like, you can't ever say, oh, I'm never going to get sick. That's not going
right.
to happen.
Yeah.
It's inevitable. So you have to take some steps in advance to sort of, or during, to make yourself better. But in this case, it affects more than just companies. It affects the people too. So that's why it's
consumers,
especially
yeah.
important.
And it's just another added insurance kind mm-hmm. of a thing, right? So, you know, you have insurance on your meat processing supply chains, like your machinery, and I'm sure, and other things like that. So this is just another added thing that they would have to probably invest in.
Exactly.
And of course, a cost benefit thing comes into play, but...
All right, well, that's the end of this episode of the X Talks Food Podcast. If you like today's show, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Thanks, everyone, and see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the X Talks Food Industry Podcast. If you enjoyed our discussions today, please share the episode with your friends and colleagues, and be sure to subscribe in order to be notified when a new episode is released. To join in on the discussion, you can find X-Talks on social media, email podcast@xtalks.com, or comment on the articles directly. Links are in the show description. Take a moment to join our community at xtalks.com to get access to everything we have to offer, including webinars, job listings, virtual meetings, articles, and more. The views and opinions expressed in the podcast are those of the speakers sharing them. They should not be taken as professional advice and do not necessarily reflect the policy or position Honeycomb Worldwide. For further information, email us at podcast@xtalks.com. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week.